Welcome to the Mentors Project podcast, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a new series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Our guest today is Colin Mitchell, author of The Faithful, a novel based on the life of Giuseppe Verdi, the opera composer who gave the world Aida, Otello, and Falstaff. As a supporter of the unification of Italy in the 1860s, he was pleased that Va Pensiero, the chorus from his opera Nabucco, became an unofficial anthem of the movement. Welcome, Colin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is very interesting to me because of my Italian heritage. I tend to start all these interviews with what I think is the most important question for potential readers, which is, why does Verdi matter to us today?
Verdi matters, I think, for a couple of reasons. One of the experiences I had writing the book and when I sort of got into the flow of it was realizing, especially in the relationships, the interpersonal relationships, that, you know, people are people and there hasn't, not much has changed, I think, you know, just in terms of the way that people interact, or at least the way I'd imagined it. So I think he's relevant, I mean, because he was there at the beginning of Italy becoming a country. And nationalism played a huge role in that. And that's something that we're talking about a lot today in 2019 that we didn't talk about not that long ago, I don't think, at least for me. I'm not quite yet 40, but I don't ever remember that really being a thing we talked about a lot, at least like in current politics. So I think he's important for that element. And also I think he's important because of who he was in his place and time. He was a celebrity. And what I found interesting about him is that he was financially successful. He was not destitute at the end.
And no starving artist.
Not a starving artist. So I think that that's relevant and important to today because we think of celebrity today as not the starving artist, but we think of them as, you know, a success. Of course, we only know about the successes, but it seems like it's always, it just feels like something that's always a part of what we think of, you know, in terms of movies and TV, you know, actors and actresses and even writers for that matter in movies and television. So I think he's important in that sense. He's kind of modern in the fact that he was happy and relatively healthy when he died.
So essentially he's the John Williams of his day?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, he's a populist, and I don't mean that in the pejorative.
Right.
But also technically skilled and passionate about the work that he did. He wasn't just like a person, I don't think, from what I read and what I wrote. You know, he wasn't, I don't know if he could at that time, but he wasn't just writing to make money. He was passionate about it. He felt something. So that's who he was.
That's beautiful. The true artist is somebody who's passionate about their work.
Yeah, and he was. I mean, he worked himself into just stricken anxiety and made himself sick. I forget which, you know, at some point in his, maybe a third of the way into his career when he was making money, I mean, he put himself into bed, you know, just in terms of the stress levels and being overwhelmed and stuff. So I think that that's relevant to everybody, whether you work in the arts or not.
Sure. We're dealing with a lot of that today. We don't realize that it happened to people in the past.
Yeah. You think it came, I don't know, they're historical figures. They did amazing things. You think it came easy, and it certainly did not for him.
I like that as a lesson, that there's a lot of hard work behind all of this.
Yeah, he was a hard worker. And I think that was something that came out very quickly, like in the research that I did. He was not like a dilettante. He wasn't arty. He didn't impress me as like an arty person. He impressed me as like a pragmatic person, but who was also just like thrown into the emotions of what music did. So that's what propelled him. But he also, I think, took a very pragmatic, practical approach to it.
So what were his childhood influences? How did he get involved in music?
It's a creation myth, I think, but it's consistent across the board. His father bought him a spinet. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
But a small piano, and he banged away on that. And that's how we got started. And then, you know, the church in his town of Il Busseto was, you know, that's where you worked. That's where you did music. That's where you started a career. I mean, it was a revelation to me a few years ago at work. I was just talking to one of my coworkers, and she's an opera singer by training. And she's like, oh, yeah, the holidays, I'm so busy, like singing and stuff. Oh, and then it came out that, you know, she got paid. And it was just like, oh, duh. You go to the different churches. They need they need people to sing because it's that time of year and you're a professional. Like, that's great. Of course you would get paid. It's not just, you're just not going to volunteer. I think actually when I was talking to her about, since she was into music and into opera, I mentioned Verdi, and yeah. And so it was just, it coalesced. And again, like something that still continues today and is relevant, but yeah, that's where he started his career, was in the church as a young kid. That was part of the book. I mean, I took a lot of creative license, so I don't know. But, I think it could be assumed that he showed up every weekend and he was paid to play. And if he wasn't paid, like, it was, didn't matter. Like, I got the impression that it was I don't want to say safe, but you're on your way. It was a career, and it was an integral part of how communities stayed together.
Exactly. That's very true about churches. They were the centers of their communities. Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. So you mentioned creative license, and that is one of the questions I like to ask, because we're taking historical figures and we're doing some historical fiction. So what's a scene that you imagine that you, what are your favorite scenes that you wrote from, you fictionalized?
Yeah, there were a lot.
Uh-huh, good.
So I'll say this much. There's a historian, I think he's Australian, named Charles Osborne, and he was like kind of my main reference. He's written a handful of books on Verdi. They all seem about the same. They're just a blow-by-blow history of his life. They were entertaining enough, and they were just great because it was just a consistent through line of this happened, this happened, this happened, with enough narrative in there to keep you kind of enthralled in the story. And so that was kind of my main source. And I coupled that with just little things about the unification of Italy, which wasn't really in the book so much. I mean, it mentioned it because it had to, but there was a lot of scenes where, yeah, I had to sort of make up characters or really extrapolate sort of main historical figures and sort of figure out, which is probably true for a lot of books in this series. Mm-hmm. But the one scene that I really, it was my favorite one, because it's when things really came together and when the characters sort of felt the most real, and also the dialogue was the most punchy and fun, was at the opera in Rome. I forget where I had it taking place. But anyways, I created this impresario character. I'll be honest, I can't remember if he exists or not in real life, but it's from his perspective, and he's standing there and he's just thinking about, like, oh my God, the opera is crazy. Like, I'm this really practical person. I'm a businessman. But then I'm in, like, probably the craziest business a sensible person could really be in. Everything goes from season to season. And he's waiting for what will become Verdi's future wife to come. She's an opera singer, and she's got sort of her friend who's really funny and coy. And they're in the presence of a lawyer who I believe I made up, or who had sort of was mentioned. Lawyers were mentioned a lot in the biography, which again is relevant to today. Everything was just like, oh, and there's publishing rights and there's lawyers. And so, yeah, it was just a good dynamic scene. You know, there was a lawyer who nobody liked, and he was very conceited, and he had this horrible wife who's winning at the gambling tables down in the lobby of the opera, and that was a thing that I learned through Wikipedia research. It's like when you go to a restaurant, and I think this a lot, you know, they don't serve alcohol or wine or beer. You're like, how do they stay in business? Like, I mean, you know, how does it work? How do the economics work? And so the same was true for the opera. They have huge overhead, and, you know, you got to pay for the celebrities that you're paying a pretty penny for certain singers and costumes. So, yeah, I think, you know, it was really risky. And so to supplement that, you had gambling. You had cards. And that's how they made money. And people hated it. Some people hated it. That was an impression I got. Some people, it was cheap and it was loud. So anyways, in this scene, the wife of the lawyer she's winning. And I'm like, oh God, of course she would. So that was when things sort of came together with it. But also, you know, it's relevant, you know, to I think what maybe happened there. And got all the different characters in there, the impresario, the actor, the lawyer, and so they were all kind of there.
Hmm. Yeah. Fun. That sounds like a game to see, and a chance to get a sense of the real world of his era.
Yes. And they're talking about him. He wasn't Verdi yet. And she's like, you should meet him. And he was like, I would like that because I don't know what I'm going to do after this. The impresario is saying this to her. I don't know what my next thing is going to be. And that was true. I'm 95% sure that was true. So yeah, that was fun. And that same conversation is being had 36 times today in Los Angeles. So that's kind of neat. And in London and, you know, wherever they make films and everything, everywhere makes films. And
exactly. We never know what is the next thing, trend that's going to pop. What's the next celebrity that's going to grab people's attention?
Right.
And we don't think about celebrityhood existing in the past. We know these characters as already famous, and we don't understand they had trajectories to how they got there.
That was a challenge with this story, is that his trajectory was just kept going. It was a perfect linear trajectory. That was my impression. He didn't have a horrible period. He did emotionally. You know, you write all these amazing things, like, when does that stop? He did doubt himself, but never for extended periods of time, maybe for a year.
But he worked through it.
So, yeah, he always had a clear line, and he ended on a bang. He ended as a national hero, and countless numbers of successes, and he had money in his bank. I don't think he burned too many bridges, and his wife still loved him. He still loved his wife. That's pretty good.
That's a success.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, speaking of his wife, what were the other relationships in his life? His parents, his wife, maybe children. What were the relationships in life that really fueled him, that really moved him forward?
Yeah. Well, he did have a first wife who was the daughter of a rich man in Il Busseto, where he grew up. He helped fund Verdi's sort of early musical career, and he fell in love with his daughter, I think, at a young age. That was a big part of the story that was there, but I really honed in on. And tragically, she died when they were very young. They had two children together. The children died first, and then she died.
Oh,
it was really tragic. And when I was writing the book, we had just had our son, and so I was kind of grateful for that, because I don't think I would have tapped into that in the same way than if I hadn't had a child. And so, yeah, his love of his life died. I mean, it sounds like that they were Romeo and Juliet, although no one ever kept them away. Like, it was encouraged, so it was even worse. There was no good part about her dying. And then he later married an opera singer who, kind of at the tail end of her career, which was like in her early 30s. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a scandal. Not kind of, it was. But what I liked about him is I think he was gruff and was like, I don't care what other people think about me. And I don't think he fretted over it too much. And he took the blows. And regardless, they were married for a really long time. And, you know, they built a legacy together. There's still a home that's used today. The name is escaping me, but it's where, I don't think it's just musicians or opera singers, but artists go there in their old age and who have not been as fortunate financially, but have been professional artists. And that home still exists today in Italy. And that's where they retire there. They live out their years there. And it's funded by his foundation or by his estate.
Which is like the Motion Picture Arts and Science, the Motion Picture Home for the Retired Actors.
Right. Yeah, it's the exact same thing.
That's so beautiful.
It is beautiful. Yeah. And he physically built the building. That's the scene in the book. Like, he chose the site and he built it with his money, and he was passionate about that. He loved gardening and farming. I think he was a gentleman farmer, or he had gentleman farms on his homes. What I love about that time period, or just anything that predates, I think, World War II, people lived modestly, even wealthy people. Not all, I don't, who knows, but
right. No, but many of them. And you're right, and they were involved in their land, even if they were rich, and if they had a garden, they were involved in designing it, like Thomas Jefferson or someone like that, designing what would grow, tending it, they wanted to understand it, and all that.
Yeah, and he did that, and, you know, I think he got his hands dirty, but, you know, he kept back, and people worked the farm. I don't know if it made money or not, but it made him really happy. And, you know, at the same time, having something like that keeps the country itself beautiful. You're not building things that are obscene. I mean, I've always been really amazed. It's a little bit of a divergent thing, but like Walt Disney, he had a very modest home in Silver Lake, especially after his successes. And that's always just really impressed me. And so if here he is kind of the Walt Disney of that era in some regard, in terms of his popularity, he had global status. He was going on boats to America, and he's going to France a lot. And he lived, you know, modestly. Now, people didn't have as much money or the resources to just, like, consume stuff. But still, that was a thing that sort of lingered with me. I really liked that because he lived in a world of glitter and gold. Like, that was the thing that annoyed him about that. Well, there's several, I think, parts in that book where he's just like, who are these people? You know, these actors. He wasn't an actor.
He didn't have that arrogant attitude that we associate.
He didn't. And I like to think that he didn't, like, suffer fools. Yeah.
That's a great phrase. What was the favorite thing you found while researching his life, the favorite detail about him?
I think just how prolific he was as an artist and as a writer. It was just kind of jaw-dropping. Like, just to... I mean, it can go two ways. You can think like, oh, well, you didn't have... Like, he's obviously innately talented, and he didn't have distractions. So, you know, you're going to get a lot of work done. But just thinking about, like, life, you know, you have 70 years, especially at that time, 60 maybe. I think just thinking about physically putting myself in his homes, in the hotels he worked in, putting myself into the theaters and opera houses that he rehearsed in, and just, like, the motivation to keep going, even when you have successes, you know, even when everyone loves you, he never took a break. And that was very impressive because life was hard even for him. I mean, you know, you didn't have, getting hot water was a difficult thing. Going, you know, your clothes, you know, things just were harder and it was more labor intensive. Now, of course, like, he was a celebrity and he didn't have to do a lot of those things probably, but still, like, you know, you had to deal with the cold and drafty windows and, like, you know, it's late at night and you have an ailment and no one can fix it. And you're still writing, you're doing this thing that, like, intrinsically has all the value in the world and also has no value. And you could quit at any time. And, you know, maybe someone in his position, people would notice, but he also had the power to say, I don't want to. And so the fact that he kept going was a detail that I really appreciated about him. Because he had money. I can't say for a fact, but he was financially successful. So, I mean, he could have stopped. And he invested well in real estate. That was something that he did, which a lot of artists don't do or couldn't do. And even if they could, they probably didn't know.
It wasn't there. No one had advised them.
But he was a son of a merchant and of a small-time merchant, like a store owner, an innkeeper. And yeah, he knew how to live life very simply.
Cool.
Yeah.
So we mentioned earlier the fact that his music was almost an anthem to the Risorgimento, the reunification of Italy. What other involvement did he have with that? How supportive?
Not a lot. He really resisted being a part of that. Yeah, it's like George Washington and the cherry tree or Abe Lincoln and living in a, you know, dirt floor log cabin. It's a very convenient creation myth. Ah. You know, you're able to put face in a song at the right time and the right place to this tremendous thing that happened, and I don't think he really wanted to be a part of it. He was apolitical. And I think he was maybe anti-political, like, just really, especially at that time. I mean, you know, that was another thing that really came to form in my mind as I was writing this book, is that governments didn't exist the way that we know of them today. You had kings and queens and princes and, like, these people who had no real business ruling anything, but they did because they married into it.
No training, exactly.
There was no training. And, but at the same time, you know, it's a very revolutionary time. You know, Napoleon was sort of creating an idea that people could run their own business. And he was definitely a Republican. I think he's called that at some point.
Oh, interesting.
I'm going to get the definition. Obviously, a Republican, that's different from what we know of today and even 30 years ago. But in a sense that, like, or maybe he was more libertarian. Like, I can do whatever I want. And the thing is, like, he wasn't a libertine.
So what in your background helped you connect to Verdi and his story?
Yeah, so I'd written some before, but this was the longest thing I'd ever written. It was the first thing I'd ever sort of been asked by someone else to write. And so that's the life that Verdi lived. I mean, especially even when he was a success. I mean, people asked him for commission things, you know. I mean, he did write a lot of what moved him, and Shakespeare moved him a lot. That was like a huge inspiration for him in terms of his writing and the stories that he kind of created or borrowed from. So yeah, it's just like, well, someone has, you know, asked that this be produced. And so in that sense, I really felt like I shared something with Verdi or with any sort of artist who's asked to sort of do something that they wouldn't have naturally gravitated toward. But I found that that made things easy because in some sense, you're sort of emotionally divested from it. So you are just looking and be like, okay, let's get to the end and make sure it makes sense. And, you know, when someone else is expecting something, you kind of step it up a little bit. And I feel like Verdi probably was in that situation a lot.
I love that. So you have no musical background in your life?
No musical background. Well, I played guitar. Right. But no, nothing musically. So that was actually, you know, that was something that I think worked in my favor because it was all new. I didn't have any prejudices going in. I had a clean mind about what this was. And so, yeah, my first impressions are probably what ended up as part of creating his story, which is probably, I didn't have a long time to mull over it or think about it. Yeah.
So did you find any themes running through his life?
Yes, I did find some themes. One was being strong-willed, and that worked into his work ethic, I think into his love life. There were rumors of an affair that have never really been substantiated. And so I think he was like really consistent in that way. So I thought that was a theme of his, a theme that sort of went through the story of just like being who you are, being consistent, and like not worrying about the outside world. And the outside world for him at that time was, you know, this major political movement, Italy coming together, breaking away from the holds of Germany and France and that whole fight. And so he really didn't he took an interest in it because I think it was intellectually interesting. And I think he also inevitably saw that, okay, I do have a role in this. I am this major person. But just sort of keeping your head down, and I think was something that like was consistent throughout his life, and I think was the theme throughout the story. That's his major conflict. As I was saying before, I got a little concerned at some point when I was doing the outline because I'm like, there's no inherent conflict in this. What's the conflict? Again, all creative license was taken, and so I really exaggerated his resistance to be a face to the Italian unification. And so that was the theme, I think, a lot that ran through the story is sort of a stubbornness about that and resisting it.
Well, there's something to be said, too, though, for artists when politics change too much. They don't want to lose their ability to keep the art going. And so there's probably a fear of if you choose the wrong side, you'll lose anyone wanting you anymore. And so you would just want to wait until that wave goes by and you can continue on the path you're on.
Yeah, that's true. Censors were a big part of his life, of any artist's life at that time. Mm. And I think that was probably something that he was just concerned with just in general, whether it was the Germans or the French or the Italians, which was like a new concept, a new idea. You know, there was always going to be some sort of censorship. And it usually just was, I think, concerned with whoever was the head of state or who was sort of in charge of that area and just making sure that nothing would sort of be offensive or untoward about them. So it's interesting. I don't know what his specific concerns were in that regard other than, you know, you just had to make sure that it was apolitical. So I guess that's sort of an irony of his whole story is that, you know, the people chose his song. And there, at that point, it was just the right time, again, because no one could really criticize it because there was such support, you know, from so many people who identified as being an Italian, which was being defined at that time, that it just sort of, like they say, it caught fire and you can't really stop it.
And it succeeded.
And it succeeded through a lot of bloodshed and war and money, but it could have been stopped.
True.
Yeah.
True. But enough people, I guess, were on that one side that mm-hmm. finally kicked over.
Yeah.
It's a crazy period because it coincides with our American Civil War, so we get so involved in studying that, certainly in America, that we don't think about all the craziness that was happening in Europe at the time.
Yeah. I mean, I did not know that Italy did not become a country until almost the 20th century.
Exactly.
Practically. I mean, you know, they sort of gained their independence at some point, you know, in the early 1870s. And then it took a long time, probably another decade, before things were really kind of locked into place.
It is fascinating because we assume it's because Italian people have existed and the Roman Empire and all of that. We assume that it's been this continuous time frame.
Yeah. Italy and Italians are so culturally identifiable. I mean, they're just like, it's a thing. It's like French culture. It's
yeah.
Italian culture, French culture. They're, in my mind, it's like all, for lack of a better word, like the stereotypes are all there. Like, you know what that is. Visually, the smells, the food, the sound. Less so maybe Germans. Less so, you know, the Spanish. But like Italians and the French are really well defined. And to realize that like it wasn't even a country, it wasn't even called Italy until not a long time ago is kind of mind-blowing.
I agree. It's one of the things I like about this series is how much people learn about European history along the way.
Definitely. Like the importance of Napoleon, which has definitely not been understated. But it really came home for me. Because honestly, it wasn't really something I'd really thought much about since whatever we read in high school. And yeah, you just sort of see those familiarities with today and knowing that they're people who love and eat food and go to the bathroom just like you. You're like, yeah, you know, whatever they were thinking at that time is probably similar to what I'm thinking right now. Things are different, obviously, but
our desires, wanting a family, wanting to be safe, wanting to be able to provide for the people that you're with. Exactly.
Yeah. So that really helped just, you know, connect with these characters. Which is probably true for everyone who's writing in this series.
True. So, speaking of which, a couple of things I always like to end asking. The first one is, who were his mentors in life?
Yeah, he had several mentors. One was his first benefactor, who was also his father-in-law.
Andy.
And they actually had a relationship throughout his career, well after his wife and his benefactor's daughter died. I really like that relationship. It's like the uncle-nephew relationship. They're not blood-related, but they just have like this kinship. And they needed each other. I mean, his benefactor, who kind of had that uncle role, was impressed with his son-in-law's success. There was probably some financial interweaving. Or there was. There was. Of course there was. I mean, he paid for his way as a young kid, and then Verdi got really rich. So, you know, you stick around.
Right. Well, and obviously they both shared the love of this woman who wasn't on the planet anymore,
right.
But they both had known her, so I'm sure there was an emotional connection there.
Definitely. Yeah. You know, Verdi had proven himself to be a pretty smart and savvy guy. Also, you know, his benefactor was, you know, a fan of music, funded it. I don't think Verdi was the first kid he threw money at, but he obviously succeeded. Then he had some teachers. There was a priest in his town, which was... you know, that sounded like they had a good relationship, and he really helped navigate sort of the political waters at the time. There was, you know, people who sort of ruled that area that were French and German.
Right.
It switched back and forth a few times. And so you had to deal with that. And so you need someone to sort of, you know, be your protector and guide you through it. And at that point in his career, it was the priest. And then, yeah, as he moved on through his life, I think just his peers became his inspiration. He worked with a few writers who wrote the librettos to his operas, who they were partners. And I think that really sort of sustained him and kept him young and kept him kind of competitive. My impression was that he was always kind of like the top dog. He definitely needed those people to sort of help keep him, I think, young and relevant. And, you know, he could sort of butt heads with and open up, you know, more creative things that he wouldn't have been able to do on his own.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, then, my favorite last question is, who are your mentors in life?
My mentors in my life. I think a lot about kind of the past and, you know, my grandparents who I didn't really know, kind of just thinking about their lives and what they did, you know, in a very generic way. You know, I kind of, you know, to get sort of spiritual, I kind of believe in Carl Jung's collective unconscious. And I think that there is like this sort of collective, like, vibration that we have a responsibility to sort of like live a life of some virtue that is similar to somebody in the past that you look up to. So it runs deep. I mean, authors who are alive now, authors who are dead, you know, filmmakers, Giuseppe Verdi. I mean, this story, I mean, you know, I spent a year writing the book. So, I mean, this has left an impression on me, which I'm grateful for as someone who's an adult. It doesn't happen a lot. I think people who are working hard and get up every day and just do their thing, regardless of what the outcome will be, is kind of what I use as like inspiration. And that's relatives, it's my parents, it's strangers, it's a new filmmaker or author I've sort of come across, and I get a sense of who they are. I'm like, wow, they keep doing this and nobody's asking for it, and they just keep doing it. So that's kind of what inspires me, and what I use as like mentorship is just the arts.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been lovely.
I agree. This was fun.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Rosanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.